Okay, good afternoon. This is Frank Simon with the rest of the news. We have an outstanding program lined up for you today. We have two special guests, Dr. Bill Smith, who's a dermatologist in Madisonville, Kentucky. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Dr. Bill. Okay, and the other special guest is Jim Waters with the Bluegrass Institute for Public Policy Solutions.
Yep.
And
we're both members of the Bluegrass Institute pension reform team
that
we've put together. So, it's a work in progress here.
What we'd like to do is tell us a little bit about what the problem is with the pension system.
Mm-hmm. The Bluegrass Institute's been working on this issue since really for about the past 5 years. We came out with a series of policy reports in 2012, looking at taking kind of a cursory beginning look at this problem of our pension system, which, by the way, threatens every aspect of our state's economy. And, you know, a lot of these announcements we've heard, Dr. Simon, are great. These job announcements, these economic development announcements. But I'm telling you, without fixing this problem, that the pension crisis will threaten every bit of our economic health and security. We have to address this. So on the one hand, the news has been great, but if we ignore the real problems here and don't make the tough decisions, we're going to pay a big price for that. So that's why we're so focused on this, because whether you're Republican, Democrat, whether you're liberal, conservative, whatever your political views, our view on this is not ideological. This is not an ideological problem. This is a math problem, and you're going to hear that. And it's also really a policy problem, how we enact sound policy so that we turn this ship around. The good news is we don't have to do that right all at once, but we do have to begin to turn this ship around in terms of our pension crisis, or we're going to be in a situation like Illinois or California or some of these other states that are now trying to raise taxes. And you know, that's not going to be the answer here. We're going to talk about what the answer is today. But the problem here is that for years, the politicians have used the pension system to curry political favor. And this has resulted in some serious problems. One of which is we have 1,700 different entities in the public pension system right now. Some of them are not even public entities. These folks were added to gain political favor for politicians in Frankfurt. And so now we have a lot of people in the system that we shouldn't even be, that should not even be getting a public retirement plan,
really?
Should not be considered as a public entity. For example, the Commonwealth Credit Union. Why is the Commonwealth Credit Union in the Kentucky public pension system? Here's a private financial institution that has $80 million in assets, $60 million in profits, something like that every year. And yet we, the taxpayers, are on the hook for 365 retirees from that one private financial institution. And these things just are wrong, and nobody was really minding the store and paying attention to this. So we've got that problem. But another huge problem here, and the one that we have focused on with this presentation, has been the unfunded liability and how that was created. It's very important to understand how we arrived at this point. I hear politicians all the time in Frankfurt say, we don't want to go back and rehash the past. That's a mistake. We have to understand how we got to a $38 billion unfunded pension liability, and that's a conservative figure, but we have to understand how we got here in order to really have the serious and have the will, the seriousness and the will to make the changes that have to be made. And a huge issue here has been that for years, Frankfurt has enhanced benefits of retirees in the state's retirement systems, and they have enhanced benefits and applied those benefits to past years. But you have to understand, we have a defined benefit system, and we're not advocating getting rid of that. But what we're saying is, if a defined benefit system is going to work, you have to follow the rules. And we've broken a couple of really important rules, one of which is, you have to, before you enhance a benefit, there has to be an analysis done of what that costs. So we have to know, can we afford this benefit? We are not opposed to benefits. We're not opposed necessarily to increasing benefits. But we are opposed to handing out benefits if we cannot afford them as a state. The worst problem on that, the other rule that's been broken, has been that not only have benefits been enhanced, but they've been applied. Those enhancements have been applied to past years. But a defined benefit system works in a horizontal nature, not a vertical nature. So every year, all of these factors go into determining what that benefit level is going to be. Now, every year it's properly funded, pre-funded. There's a reserve created so that when those beneficiaries retire, that benefit is already funded.
Yeah.
But the problem is, if you raise that benefit and you enhance that down the road and you come back and do it for that year, it hasn't been properly funded and it has thrown the system into total chaos. And we have a real crisis here. So you can't break those rules. So that's what we're really focusing on here. In Frankfurt, you'll hear a lot about the funding issue. You'll hear a lot about returns on investments. But if you look at the past 30 years of invested funds from the retirement system, our return over that period of time, and that's the way actuaries should look at that, the long-term thing has not been bad at all. We've done pretty good on our returns on investments. And the funding, certainly, we put over a billion additional dollars in the pension system just in Governor Bevin's first budget 2 years ago. But without fixing these problems, that additional funding is just like throwing money down the hole, because we continue to go down this path of funding benefits that were not properly funded, or handing out benefits that were not properly funded. So that's an introduction to where we're headed.
Well, let me give out the call-in number. If you have questions for Dr. Bill or Jim Waters, just give us a call at 571-0970, and we'll try to answer the questions. Well, Dr. Bill, are those abuses and breaking the rules still going on now?
Not as much today as they have in the past. Most of the abuses occurred in the 80s and 90s when we had extraordinary investment performance with our asset portfolios. And so those abuses have occurred in the past, which is one of our concerns with regard to the recent performance audit, which only went back to 2004. So the audit report doesn't show the abuses that occurred in the past. But what I've done, rather than looking just at the past 10 or 12 years, is we've looked at every financial report since inception, so 1958 forward, and that's where we discovered that these abuses were occurring.
58, way back in 1958.
And it's very important, and Jim gave a very good overview of the type of system that we have. These are actuarial reserve systems. They're very different than Social Security and Medicare, where you have a pay-as-you-go system. So the purpose of having an actuarial reserve system is that employees and their employers fund their own benefits. And the process used to fund those benefits is called actuarial pre-funding. So the critical aspects of actuarial pre-funding are that you have an actuarial cost analysis. You have to know how much those benefits are going to cost, and you have to have pre-funding, which means the funding occurs at the time the benefits are awarded and earned and before any benefits are paid out.
And we just haven't been doing that. We haven't gotten the money ahead of time.
Yeah. What's really interesting is that all of these systems actually do have a full set of actuarially pre-funded benefits, but those benefits change over time. So as an employee pursues a career, over the period of that career, those benefits are going to be enhanced, and those enhancements are applied retroactively to benefits that were properly pre-funded with complete disregard to the cost. Now, that's something that can be done. We can have retroactive benefit enhancements. There's not a good reason for doing that most of the time, but let's assume that the legislature decides that some benefits were too low and they wanted to enhance them retroactively. They would have to perform an actuarial analysis to determine the cost of those benefits, and they would have to have the money to fund that benefit immediately. And so what's happened is they've ignored the requirement for an actuarial analysis, and they've awarded the benefits without any money. And so they had no funding for the benefits. When that happens, the cost of those benefits is amortized, typically over a 30-year period or longer in the past. And that's charged to future employers. And so they're just assuming that future employers are going to have the funding for those benefits and that they will fund them retroactively.
Okay. If you have questions, call 571-0970, and we have be right back. Okay, we're back. We're just talking more about this retirement plan. I was just bringing up that it seems to me there was a time when we weren't sure how much we were in debt and who is the money owed to and all of that. Can you want to?
Yeah. Well, and that's a very important point, that we need to have a more transparent pension system. And the Bluegrass Institute, during the last election, we asked all of the candidates, including incumbents and even lawmakers who were retiring, to sign a 67-word pledge that they would support making the legislators' pension system transparent. And that's something we set as a goal 5 years ago to begin at that point, and from that point to push more push throughout the system for more transparency, because we have to know more about what's going on in order to really come up with the right solutions. And, you know, so we can estimate and we can give our best guess, but when you actually have the information about which beneficiaries and how many are getting, for example, how many are double dipping, how many are getting a six-figure pension, you know, and it's not everybody. Most state workers have a modest pension, but there are a few hundred people that are really gaming the system. And so, you know, I think opening it up, and there was a couple of transparency bills that passed this session, including our legislative pension transparency bill, which passed by a 95-1 vote in the House. And so there is some really good support there, I think, on both sides of the aisle for more openness in the system. And the states that have done this, like the state of Oregon, in Nevada, and other states, have been able to make more progress with these other issues. So it's not that we talk about transparency for transparency's sake. It's that we talk about it so that we can actually have the right solutions that actually do address the problems that we have. It's easy for a politician to go to Frankfurt and talk about more money. I mean, have you ever heard a politician ever say, "We have enough of your tax dollars, please don't send us any more"? I mean, you'll never hear that. And the point being here is, Dr. Simon, we're not going to fix this problem simply by raising taxes or coming up or throwing more money at the system. There has to be a structural, there has to be a solution, a prescription, which we have, and it needs to be applied to the structural imbalance and problems of this, of the retirement system.
So, well, why was there trouble figuring out how much we were in debt and who was getting the money and everything?
Well, that's a very good question. Actuarial debt is different from other types of debt in that it changes based on a set of actuarial assumptions. And that recently occurred with the Kentucky retirement system, where they reduced their investment return assumption from 7.5 to a lower 5% figure. And so when you change your investment return assumption, the amount of money required to fill your actuarial reserve goes up, and that can go up significantly. And those actuarial assumptions can vary on a year-to-year basis. So when you hear different reports, $34 billion, $38 billion, $85 billion. Those depend on the investment return assumptions that are being used to perform that calculation.
Right. Okay. Well, is there a right way and a wrong way to do all of this?
Well, the critical aspect with regard to actuarial assumptions is that they be based on empirical data. And so to this point, the investment return assumptions in particular have been overly optimistic. And for good reason, because the beneficiaries earn more benefits when the investment return assumptions are higher. So if you look at the value of normal cost payroll contributions, the payroll contributions that you're contributing to the system, the actuarial value of those payroll contributions is higher if you expect to earn more in your investment portfolio.
Right.
Yeah, you know, one of the problems, too, has been that we've built silos with these problems in Frankfurt. For example, the level of benefit depends on the assumed rate of return and the actual returns and the contribution of employees and their employer agencies. But we right now we have a problem with this because we have the retirement systems boards are determining the information about investment returns and the contributions of employees, but we have the legislators determining and setting what the benefits are going to be. But those things have an actuarial relationship. So we need to change that so that the retirement systems boards need to be held accountable both for the rates of returns and also setting the benefit level based on what those returns are going to be. And because that hasn't been done, then you just sort of have an arbitrary figure of what the benefit factor is going to be without really any idea of whether we can afford it, what this is going to cost, and how we're going to pay for this.
Well, it seems to me the legislature ought to be in control because they have to get the money.
Well, I think the problem here has been, you can look, it's probably different ways to do this, but the problem has been legislators maybe haven't been given the right information by the actuaries in the system. And remember, and I think we need, like Ohio and other states have, we need an independent actuarial analysis of our system. We need it to be independent. If there's a proposal for a benefit, it needs to be independent of the systems. Someone, because right now, the beneficiaries have their actuaries. They work for the beneficiaries. And then the legislators are torn between, you know, being accountable to the taxpayers and citizens, but also they have the beneficiaries here in the systems. So we need somebody looking out for the taxpayers here because we're carrying the lion's share of this. When we did our reports in 2012, we discovered that the average employee in the retirement system or average beneficiary was funding about 5.5 years of their retirement. And the rest of it was being funded by taxpayers. So we taxpayers deserve to have an independent actuarial analysis done of any benefit enhancement proposals or any spending proposals. And whether it's the legislators that do that or the systems, there needs to be accountability and there needs to be an understanding that these things do not operate separate of each other. These things are connected. You know, the benefit factor must be set at the level at which it can be properly pre-funded. And that decision is made on the empirical data that Dr. Smith is talking about. And I think legislators have been given bad information sometimes. And so they thought and because the beneficiaries have their actuaries looking out for them. And like he made the point earlier, the higher the expected return on investments, for example, the higher the benefit. So rather than basing that decision in the past on what was actually happening, the beneficiaries really, or the actuaries for the beneficiaries really, really were, we'll say overly optimistic about that. So, and that was for several years. I mean, this is not like this happened 1 or 2 years. This happened for several years.
So. Well, what do you think the answer is to all of this?
Well, the first question we typically get is, can we roll back some of these improperly enhanced benefits? And the answer to that is no. Obviously, politically and strategically, that would be essentially impossible. But what we do think needs to happen is that we need to stop the bleeding, to use a medical metaphor. And so we have to freeze the current benefit accrual rates. Currently, if you look at these systems, in some cases you have 2 or 3 tiers of beneficiaries earning benefits at various rates, which is completely inappropriate because the actuarial value of their payroll contributions is the same and independent of the date of hire. And so we have to freeze the current plan, which means the current benefit accrual rates for every individual needs to cease. And then moving forward, we need to establish a legitimate actuarial reserve system.
So you would freeze the system now? Did I understand that?
Right. And we have to be very careful with the terminology. Freezing the system doesn't mean you lose accrued benefits.
Yeah.
We would honor all the benefits that have been accrued up till that date.
Yeah.
And moving forward, we would have a more legitimate and properly managed actuarial reserve system that maintained this relationship between your benefits and your actuarial assumptions. It's a very meaningful relationship. And Jim mentioned the fact that these are horizontally integrated. Very critical. So if you earn a benefit in 1960 and that benefit has an actuarial cost based on the actuarial assumptions in 1960, you have to make sure that when those individuals who earned that benefit retire, that's the benefit they actually get for that year of service.
Well, what is it going to, is it like a new law that has to be passed in order to straighten this out?
Well, unfortunately, I think the actuaries have been part of the problem. And as Jim mentioned, they all work as fiduciaries for the beneficiaries.
Yeah.
So they've allowed the legislators to get sloppy with actuarial pre-funding. If we had maintained our actuarially pre-funded benefits, if you have a pre-funded benefit for a specific year of service and made sure that every individual beneficiary received those benefits when they retired, we wouldn't have that problem. So I think maybe it's an educational campaign on it, because I think the legislators want to do the right thing.
Well,
and I think they do now. I think that's a good point to also insert here is a lot of these problems were created by legislators who are long gone from the General Assembly.
Yeah.
But that's the problem is that by the time the bill comes due, Dr. Simon, they're gone and there's no accountability. So we have to make sure that that's there.
Okay. If you want to call in, the number is 571-0970. We have to take a break and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back again. We were just talking about what we can do about this. It seems like there has been legislation introduced that would require the actuary to be independent of the people
well, it
that
needs
are getting
to be
the
introduced.
Money.
It needs to be introduced, yeah. And by the way, we have a whole lot of recommendations. Probably don't have time to talk about all those today. But we're certainly willing to come and speak to groups about this. The Bluegrass Institute has our pension reform team, and Dr. Smith has led this effort, done a great job, and a lot of work on this. And we have really some free market, but mainly common sense recommendations about this. And like, you know, we went back and looked all the way back to 1980 when the statute was originally put in place that there must be an actuarial analysis done before a benefit enhancement is offered or given. And that law's only been followed one time. And that was in 1998. And that one time that was done, the actuary said, don't do this. Do not enhance these benefits. The legislature totally ignored the actuaries. So there's a lot of blame there for legislators. But and then during that year, Dr. Smith, that was the same year that they not only enhanced the benefit factor, but they changed the formula of the pension system, yes. Right? To a high from a was a high five to high three, or am I getting that right?
Well, so you're exactly correct. They changed the final compensation formula, which means they changed the formula used to determine the final compensation upon which these benefits are predicated. And so typically the benefits would start out being predicated upon an average of the final 5 years of service, but they changed that to final three. And of course that enhances the benefits further. They made several mistakes with that particular benefit enhancement. And that happens to be the system that's the most poorly funded system, the KERS non-hazardous system. They increased the benefit factor from 1.97, which was already retroactively enhanced multiple times in the past, to 2. And then they created a 15-year window that allowed people to retire with a 2.2% benefit factor. And it's really important to understand from an actuarial perspective, that may not sound like a lot of money, but that's a 10% increase from 2 to 2.2. And so these fractions of a percentage make a significant difference. They applied those retroactively. So if you had been in the system for 30 or 40 years, every benefit for every year was now enhanced to that higher number. And they also created an incentive. With a 15-year window, that gave people an incentive to retire if they were eligible to do so. So that's what happened with the KERS non-hazardous system. It was under the assumption they had extra money from the 20 years of exceptional investment performance between 1980 and 1990. They were earning 13% annually.
Wow.
And so they were doing very, very well. And so they misinterpreted their data to suggest that they actually had 140% funding levels, so they wanted to spend that money. But when they did so, they hired an independent actuary to perform an actuarial analysis. His recommendation was not to enact that benefit enhancement, but they proceeded anyway.
And this if you look at like the county employees retirement system, and we have in our presentation includes a chart showing that, and I think that'd be good to really talk about here. I was looking for the actual numbers. The long and short of that is because of those enhancements, a person, for example, that began working in 1958, right? It really increased by a tremendous, from like 50% to 70%.
I'll go through these numbers if you like. Yeah. If you look at the system in 1958 and you look at the CERS non-hazardous system, the benefit factor for that year was 1.25%. And our graph has a hypothetical employee who's worked for the system for 33 years until 1990. At that point, the benefit factor was 2.2%. the system and the legislature inadvertently applies each one of those enhancements retroactively. Well, the reason those benefits were increasing is because their assumed rate of return was increasing. And so their investment return assumption in 1958 was 3%. In 1990, it was 8%.
Mm.
And so those benefits accrue. And what should have happened, because the benefits accrue, and because they're horizontally integrated with actuarial assumptions in place at that time, they should have simply added those 33 numbers. And they would have had a specific benefit that would have been appropriate and would have been actuarially pre-funded. But what they chose to do is they applied the highest benefit factor for any year of service to every other year of service.
So their wow.
Their benefits increase, they can never decrease, and all increases are applied retroactively. So imagine any kind of investment where you had a variable return ranging from 3% to 8% over a 33-year period of time, and you demanded to have the 8% applied to every year. That's what happened.
Wow.
And then and that resulted in, and I was looking for the exact number here, but that resulted in the difference in the final percentage of a person's salary being the benefit. That resulted in a huge unfunded liability right there, because it was like it should have been.
If you compare the benefit that actually was earned and pre-funded to the benefit that was awarded to that particular individual, it's a 42% enhancement for everyone working during that period of time.
Yeah. Okay.
So the benefit that they received was 42% higher than what was properly funded.
Well,
and if people want a benefit, here's the deal is, this is an emotional thing because we're talking about people's individual future retirements.
Yeah.
But if we want to have a system here, keep in mind the Kentucky Employee Retirement System by its own board's now evaluation is only 13% funded. And this is almost insolvent. So if we want to have a retirement and keep our promises, we're going to have to make some changes.
Right. Yeah. And let's talk about what changes we should make at this point. Okay, it's time for a break. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. So we're just talking about what needs to be done at this point. It seems that the actuaries need to be working for the taxpayer.
Yeah, and right now, taxpayers don't even have standing. Like if somebody wanted to sue this system, you know, and really bring this to light, it has to be somebody in the system, a beneficiary, a retiree. Taxpayers don't have any standing. And yet bottom line is we're 100% responsible. Taxpayers are 100% responsible for what happens here. And we were talking off break, and I think this is a hugely important point. A defined benefit system, again, depends on the actuarial relationship between assumed rate of return, actual rate of returns, employee and employer contributions, all those things. So some years, just like your personal investments, you'll have some years that investments are higher than other years.
Yes.
So it's really this system, if it was operating correctly as a defined benefit system, we should see that fluctuating as well, because the benefit factor, the level of benefit, is determined by rates of returns. And if they're down, so the benefit should go down as well.
Right.
Other
right.
years, if it's up, it should go up. So, and I think that's a hugely, that's something we haven't, because as Dr. Smith was saying, on the break, you were saying that beneficiaries are just have this idea that once a benefit is enhanced, that for 1 year, that it applies to every year.
Now, see,
retroactively
that
or prospectively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is there was a lot of talk about people that are double dipping, that they're getting retirements from more than one source from the government. Is that right?
Well, Lowell Reese, who helped us with this, the late Lowell Reese, used to say that double dipping was just part of the culture of Frankfurt. You know, and that's why we want to have transparency in the system so that we can we have legislators like Jody Richards from Bowling Green. You know, he's been in the legislature since 1976. He has maxed out probably two pensions, maybe on his third pension. So we're going to be finding out now that the legislature system, you know, we can find out about the legislative pensions, but we still can't get the information about all the other systems and the retirees. So we need to have all that out on the table. If the systems are going to ask taxpayers to step up and fund additional billions of dollars, it cannot be done without transparency.
Right.
Yeah, it's not acceptable. So
now, how did he get three pensions?
Well, because after you're there for a certain amount of time and the level of your benefit rises to a certain point, you max out, what's called max out of that. So when a legislator, for example, maxes out of their legislative pension, they're automatically enrolled in a pension in the KERS, which is very ironic considering that the KERSs are in the worst shape of all of our pension systems, and yet we have politicians who have contributed to that problem with their own pension, a second pension. And look, our founders never intended for people to go to Frankfurt and make a career and become millionaires off the taxpayers. We have seen this. They never intended for that. They meant for people to leave their practices, their fields, their businesses, and go to Frankfurt and serve and then come home and live under the same laws that they created for everybody else. And we have a huge problem today in Washington and Frankfurt because that's not happening.
Now, what is KERS?
Well, that's the Kentucky Employees Retirement System. And that's the non-hazardous, which is where we put a lot of we did a lot of research on that in terms of the funding level, because we have a 13% funding level right now with the KERS. And we're getting very close to being a pay-as-you-go system, which, as Dr. Smith said earlier, that's not the way these systems are set up. And so we're becoming very close, I think, to be having an insolvent system. And so what it means is, rather than a system where actuarial reserves are created every year to fund those pension benefits for that year, right now we have totally thrown all of that into chaos because these rules have not been followed.
Right. Tell me again now, Kentucky
Employees Retirement System. Let me just, there are two main retirement systems and they're umbrellas. So you have the Kentucky retirement systems, and part of that is the KERS, the state police, the legislative system, the judges system. Then you have the TRS, which is the teachers retirement system. So if you really want to think about two large retirement systems in Frankfurt.
Okay, we got a caller. Jim, what do you have to say?
Yes, good morning. I belong to KERS Hazardous Duty Retirement. What's the probability that that's going to remain not solvent, but be able to pay benefits, per se, for the next 40 years?
Okay.
Did you say the hazardous or the non-hazardous system?
The hazardous duty. Hazardous.
Well, I think there's a very high probability that that will remain solvent. It's the non-hazardous system that is having such difficulty. And I do think that the legislature and the governor are very committed to honoring all accrued benefits. So I don't think people need to worry about accrued benefits. Now, if you're still an active member and you're still working, there's a very good possibility that your benefit accrual rates, the benefits you earn on an annual basis, will change in the future. And I think that's probably necessary for all of these systems.
Okay. Well, you answered my question. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your service. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I would have a question, too, I think there's a lot of retirees out there or current workers who will be retirees who are willing, if they know this information, and we have presented this in the past to state retiree groups and beneficiaries, even the ones who are already retired, but even people who are right now working, I'd like to know, are they open to actually making some structural changes? And maybe they wouldn't get as high of a benefit, but they would have a lot more security in knowing
that the system
is fixed. So again, if we were really trying to just take benefits away from people, we wouldn't be talking about how to address these problems within the system. We would say, just figure out what we owe everybody, give them a check, and that's it, you know. But we've talked about this, and I think this is a really better way of approaching this.
So. Well, and I think we're actually advocates for the beneficiaries, because many people look at the system, and without taking the deep dive that we've taken, looking at all the financial reports and actually figuring out what's happening from an actuarial perspective, just want to freeze the system and go to a 401k. And that's the easiest solution. Everybody understands how 401k is managed and operates, but that's also going to provide the lowest benefits for the current employees. Now, our approach is different. We want to stop what's happened in the past and move forward with a legitimate actuarial reserve system. So you have this meaningful relationship between your benefits and your assumed rate of return and your payroll contributions, and that's recalibrated on an annual basis.
Now, who is in the Kentucky KERS? Employee retirement system.
That's most of your average state worker is in that system, and then legislators who have maxed out of their pensions are in there, and you have that's the largest single group, I believe, of all the retirement systems. Then you have the teachers' retirement system, I think, is the next largest. I think so, but it's your average state worker. These are the hardworking people, you know, who work and make state government run. I mean, if you call in the state government, it's going to be a person in the system who's going to answer the phone and help you get to the right person, help you get the information you need. So this is not about being against those people. The ironic thing here is that during the Bashir administration, Dr. Simon, we began talking about how that this problem is going to crowd out every other funding and every other program if we don't fix it. And that's when state workers themselves started getting pink slips, furloughs. They were the ones that were actually suffering the first. They're on the front lines of this. So they're the ones we don't want to see that happen. We don't want to see this
right.
go belly up.
So they're actually being laid off.
Well, they were. Bashir, you know, tried to fix some of our state budget problems by giving them a few days off unpaid.
Wow. Okay.
And they're the ones that we're talking about here right now.
So, okay. The call-in number is 571-0970. We're on a break and we'll be right back. Well, we're trying to finish up here. Now, Dr. Smith, would you tell us what it's like if there was a freeze? Can you give us an example?
Yes, it's a very important question. If we are to have a freeze, what's going to happen in the future is that we're going to adopt empirically based actuarial assumptions, and the benefits would naturally be lower to have a relationship to those actuarial assumptions in the assumed rate of return. So let me give you an actual example of what might happen with a real beneficiary. If someone had worked for 30 years and for the first 15 years of their employment earned a benefit of 2% per year of service, and the system had been frozen after 15 years and the benefit accrual rate was reduced to 1.5%, they would earn a benefit of 52.5% of their final average salary rather than 60% of their final average salary.
So that's not too bad.
It's a reduction. You know, what you might see is that people might work a little bit longer to reach that higher level
of
benefit, but that would be beneficial to the system, clearly. But it would be far more beneficial to them than a 401k after the freeze. And so,
right. Because a 401k, they'd have to put their own money in.
Right. And you know, when these systems were set up initially, these were set up back in the 1950s or 60s, some of them. And the average expected lifespan was a lot lower. So now, in many cases, we have retirees who are collecting a benefit for longer than they actually worked in the system. So the reality is that I think we need to look at maybe some things where we could incentivize people to work a little bit longer, you know, I think that might help.
The mortality rates are critical issues as well, because what happens over decades, you have increasing longevity, reduced mortality rates, but our system would accommodate for that, because that's an actuarial assumption. Longevity is one of the actuarial assumptions that are used to calibrate the system.
Right.
And so if over a period of time the longevity increased, the benefit accrual rates would go down, assuming all other actuarial assumptions were the same. But we have a system that freezes the benefit accrual rates and guarantees them prospectively. So longevity becomes a major issue because you can't adjust the benefit accrual rates for longevity.
Right. So, but if they froze it, they would get a little bit less money, but they would be pretty sure they're going to get it.
It would be a guaranteed benefit.
Yeah.
A defined benefit. You would calculate the final benefit by adding the benefit accrued before the freeze.
Yeah.
And the benefit accrued after the freeze. So it's very simple math. Mm-hmm. And the benefit would still be substantial relative to what you would expect in the private sector.
Yeah, because I was thinking, I have a retirement plan, but I funded it all myself. Nobody, the government didn't help me fund it.
Well, and when we're looking at how we're going to fix this problem, you simply cannot ignore the people who carry the greatest amount of risk for this, which are the taxpayers.
Yeah.
So I think we saw a sea change in the House of Representatives in November.
Yes.
Because I think people want real solutions. Taxpayers want real solutions to this problem. And we talked about what a 13% level would means for the KERS. I know we're pretty much out of time, but what does that mean, a 13% funding level?
Well, actuaries calculate the present value of future benefit obligations for any system. So let's assume you had a system that had $1 billion of future benefit obligations. That would mean you need $1 billion in the bank today to meet all of your future obligations based on your assumed rate of return. If you have a system that's funded at a 13% level, you only have $130 million in the bank. And everything is predicated on the assumption that you have a full actuarial reserve. In other words, you have $1 billion earning your assumed rate of return on an annual basis.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so difficult, is because now you have to replenish the actuarial reserve, but you also have to replace the earnings that would have been generated by the full actuarial reserve.
Yep. And you know, Dr. Simon, I think taxpayers, again, we need independent actuarial analysis.
Yeah, yeah.
We need the taxpayer's voice needs to be heard.
Yeah.
And I'm just so thankful for Dr. Bill Smith and the work he's done on this issue. I think this is I think this is a good plan for our state.
Okay. Well, one in the hand is worth two in the bush. It's okay. Well, we're out of time. Tune in again next week for the rest of the news.